You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony. My name is Rick Clevel. I'm the host of Narrative Species. My guests for this episode are Jorge Chan and Dwayne Godwin. Their new book is Out of Your Mind. It's a book of neuroscience. Thank you for joining me, Dwayne and Jorge.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
So, you know, this book does something that I think, and it makes it clear it's doing it, and it's something that's not often examined, and since it does it so openly, I want to examine it, which is books like this. This is a book about neuroscience. It tells us the latest and greatest understanding that we have, and boy, that has changed a lot. It changes really fast. And I think one of the things that you do is you present the chapters and what you're going to write as a series of questions, and then you give us the answers to those questions. I think it's so important. The import of asking a good question cannot be exaggerated, because no matter how good the answer is, if the question isn't well-formed and concise, then your answer, you know, might as well just be a drivel. So talk about creating the questions behind this book. Was that one of the first steps?
Yeah, I can speak to that a little bit, Dwayne, and then feel free to jump in. But that's something that we definitely thought about and talked a lot about from the beginning. You know, there is one route we could have taken, which is to basically write a textbook about the brain, and you would maybe break down the topics in a very orderly fashion. But for me, you know, being not a brain scientist, that didn't quite tickle my curiosity. And so the idea that we discussed was, well, what if we centered the book around questions that everybody has? You know, we all have a brain, we all use the brain, but maybe we're not very informed brain users. And so we betted that there were a lot of these questions, very fundamental questions that everybody had, like, why do we love? Why do we hate? What does it mean to be conscious? What does it mean to be human? And so we just thought that was maybe a better way to draw readers in. And then the tricky part was to basically fit a textbook around those questions. Right, Dwayne?
Yeah, I would say that, you know, my experiences from academics and being an educator and actually teaching courses and how the brain works to medical students and graduate students for decades. And what was appealing about this to me is that I knew that if people knew what I knew, they would be really excited about this material. But the challenge was not to do it in a way that would be off-putting, or where the jargon and different terminologies that we use in brain science would be a barrier to understanding. And part of the reason behind the questions is, you know, that's how I started out as a neuroscientist. And what really compelled me about the brain and studying the brain was I had these, I mean, the first question we ask is, where is you? And that was something that I grappled with even as a kid. I was wondering, you know, where am I? You know, I feel like I'm behind my eyes. You know, I'm looking out, and when I think of me, I think of this creature that's behind my eyes. And really my consciousness and my sense of who I was sort of centered in vision very much and visual imagery. So I feel like the questions were very compelling. They are questions that mankind, humankind, personkind has struggled with over millennia. And part of the compelling aspect of the book to me was we do bring out some of the historical examination and ideas behind what it meant to have a brain and what the brain did and how we learned some of those things.
Jorge, one of the things that I loved about this book was the illustrations and the art design. And I'd like you to talk about tempering blocks of text with illustrations and making your illustrations compelling, but not so that they would overwhelm the message of the text, but complement it.
Yeah, great question. That's also something we put a lot of thought in. For me, I'm a cartoonist. I'm a super visual person. I like to process things visually, think about them visually. Just for me to sort of see a whole page of text is a little bit hard. For me, there has to be some sort of visual component to make it at least visually or to motivate me to keep reading. And so for me in this book, the balance that we found was about every two paragraphs or about once a page, you should see some sort of illustration or cartoon. But more than just the visual aesthetic of it is I think the cartoons do a really important role, which is to not just sort of break the narrative and give you a little bit of a pause to digest all of this really dense information that we're talking about, sometimes about experiments or about things we've learned about the brain, but also just to kind of give you some context into what you just read. Cartoons have this wonderful ability to, kind of put us in a good mood as soon as you see a cartoon. And then especially if there's a little bit of a joke in there, it really kind of makes you see things in a different way. It gives you a little bit of a different perspective about what you just read. And so that combination of receiving this information in the text and then having a cartoon sort of help you process what you just read, I think is sort of the key to this book.
Yeah. The thing I would add about that is that Jorge and I have actually been working together for over 15 years in the context of delivering this kind of complex information about neuroscience to lay audiences. For several years, we were regular contributors to Scientific American Mind, which was a magazine about brain science. And we had a one pager in every single issue for the better part of 10 years. So a part of that is just we had the thought that wouldn't it be just a neat tweak to people's noses to convey what is thought of as the most complex composition of matter in the known universe using the what is thought of as very simple storytelling methods, which is comics. And the thing about comics that I love, and what compels me about using comics as a storytelling device, is that you can put the information basically from any perspective that you can imagine and can render in three dimensions. It doesn't rely on having a super sexy microscope image. It's, whatever you can produce as an icon that can stand for certain elements that your own brain then brings information and the story to life. So to me, that was the thing that was really useful and helpful about that. And honestly, if Jorge and I had not collaborated for so long and sort of understood each other's rhythms and sensibilities, I think this book would have been really much harder than it was. It was hard, right? But, I think we started not at zero. We started at like 7.5 and we eventually got to 10.
Yeah, I would say there was a lot of trust. I definitely felt a lot of trust from you, and I definitely trusted you a lot just from our history of working together. If you said something about that about the science that wasn't right or suspicious, that's it. We had to change it. And I think you also trusted me to find the sort of right level of simplification or the right tone for certain sections.
Yeah, and I think we could. I'm sorry, I was just going to say, I think we could critique each other without getting offended, which is, it's an important quality because sometimes, you feel sort of ownership over an idea or about a way to express something. But that level of trust allowed us to say, you know what, we're doing this in service of this idea of this book. And I think, I know I felt that. There was a lot of give and take between the two of us, but it was built on a foundation of extreme trust.
It's interesting to me that in a book about the mind, the composition and creation of that book was certainly abetted by your long working relationship, which enabled you to essentially read one another's minds. And that you learned, had to learn and be examples of the lessons of the knowledge that you impart to make it so work so well.
I think that's spot on. The thing about this book that I found really interesting from a personal perspective is that there were chapters of this book that in writing it and doing the research and putting it on the page actually changed me. You know, it was a process that actually, you know, made me sort of rethink my assumptions about certain things. And there's a chapter, for example, on happiness where, you know, the premise is essentially, is there a formula for happiness? And I hadn't really thought about that before. You know, what are the things that go into making us feel contentment or, you know, create ecstasy or really positive emotions in a person? And it was really just sort of going through the research and figuring out that, hey, you know, people have studied this. There are scientific studies on what it means to be happy, what it means to be content. And also there are wonderful stories related to the philosophy of happiness and how people have arrived at an understanding of how folks that may be going in for counseling, what sorts of therapies might be useful to them based on what we know scientifically about what makes people happy.
One of the things that I really liked about this book, and it was kind of in the background, what is this idea of storytelling? Because by my understanding, humans are, and that's the name of this podcast, a narrative species. If I ask you who you are, both of you are going to tell me a story, and it's the story that your brain has constructed of yourself over many, many years. And so I'd like you to talk about using the storytelling brain to tell the story of the brain. It's a kind of, you know, you guys were lifting yourself by your bootstraps.
Yeah, for sure. It's an interesting phenomenon, right? It's two brains who wrote a book about the brain trying to understand the brain so that other brains can read it. We actually sort of talk about that in the conclusion chapter, right, Wayne, where we, you know, make you think a little bit about just the idea that you're reading this book or maybe hearing these words. It's just an incredible feat of nature that to create something that can do that. But it is a really interesting point that you brought up about storytelling, because I feel Dwayne, like you and I have very different storytelling techniques. Like, you know, I come from the world of comics where it's very direct. And I also produced YouTube videos for a long time. So I'm just like, let me give you the information right away. Let me just tell you what the answer is. But you definitely came at it, thankfully, with really more of a, let's take a step back and let's talk about some of the history and let's set the scene. And so I think the book is really cool in that, you know, it breaches those two extremes. Like, you know, we have a broad palette that we use in our telling of the book. You know, sometimes we take a step back and we go into the history, which is really cool. And sometimes the book just, you know, kind of talks very directly to you and tells you the answer. And so it's a really, I think, one of my favorite things about the book.
I would agree with that. I tend to approach things more like a builder, you know, laying the foundation and then building the walls up and putting the roof on. And I think what you bring in is just that extra spice of creativity that gets us to the point very quickly. And I think it was a good mashup between the two of us and continues to be.
Absolutely. It's really fun to read. Let's talk a little bit about what's in it. And you begin with a very good question. Where is the mind? And so we all have long been conditioned to think that, as you said, Dwayne, earlier, it's somewhere there behind our eyes. But you guys go into this and tell the story of this. Talk about creating the story and balancing the pictures in that one part, which I think it's super effective. It's really fun to read and to see, you know, Dwayne's and George's brains waving to us in the beginning.
Well,
Yeah, well, that was an interesting process, I would say. I was Dwayne always writes the first draft, and he wrote this one for this. Actually, this was part of our book proposal. And when I first got it, I was like, really? Do we really want to start with that question? It's so abstract. And shouldn't we start with something more direct? But then it turned out to be, I think, maybe the best or the perfect question to set the stage for the book and for it to be the first chapter, because it let us talk a little bit about the history of brain science and kind of point towards some of the later chapters. So I'm glad I was wrong, Dwayne.
Well, you may have been completely correct for a different audience. I don't know. For me, in writing, it's about who I'm envisioning when I'm telling the story. And honestly, when I was writing this, I was thinking about little Dwayne, how I would try to approach this with an earlier version of myself. And it, as I mentioned, it was one of my inspirations for getting involved in neuroscience and becoming a scientist was, asking this very basic question. And I felt, this telling some of the history of how we started and how humanity started to determine how different parts of the brain functioned by these happy discoveries from unfortunate tragedies, where you would have patients that would present with strokes or injuries, and those injuries would tell you something about where the particular functions of the brain were. That seemed like an important way to start. Going all the way back to Aristotle, who thought that the brain was just a glorified radiator and that where the action actually was in the heart, And I think you helped me sort of develop that idea as well about, things come from the heart and, it's natural to think about that. And our pulse quickens when we're excited. So those ancient ideas about what the heart did versus what the brain did were actually very compelling. And it's really only relatively recently, last few hundred years, we've had brains for millions of years, right? But, it's only in the few last few thousands of years, hundreds of years, that we've started to observe patients who come to physicians with certain maladies, like a stroke, and how that stroke affects their ability to communicate. And that allows us to make inferences as scientists about what that means to where the functions of the brain are located. So I think that history was actually very important. And, one of the things I think is a favorite of our editor was one of the last images where you start talking about gut flora as being an important contributor to, our mind and what our mind is about. And we're learning more and more about the relationship between, how certain bacteria can affect our mood, how it might allow us to metabolize certain drugs that make it to the brain in different ways. And that last image where you're sort of flushing and saying goodbye. By me, I thought that was pretty funny, and I think the editor enjoyed that too.
Every time you flush the toilet, you're saying goodbye to a little bit of you, part
A
of you.
little bit of you.
One of the things I think is really effective are the comic interludes that you put in, Jorge. Could you talk about, creating those as kind of, both as bridging structures and also as just a wonderful kind of like super short stories? I think that's one of the most effective aspects of this book is by breaking it up. It's almost in a sense like a collection of short stories or connected short stories. At the end, you understand your brain, yourself, and that's a pretty great payoff.
Yeah, great question. This is something that actually took us a while to figure out, right, Dwayne? Like at the beginning, we had a lot. We were brainstorming, and we had just different ideas. Like maybe the whole book could be one big comic. I think maybe I wonder if our publisher and an editor would have maybe liked that because they do publish some really high-end comics and graphic novels. We brainstorm about, maybe the chapter starts with text, but then it switches to comics, and then it closes on text. But then at the end, it turned out to the to be the sort of the best way to sort of break that format was in between chapters and put these comics in between. That felt the best. And it was also a little bit of a savings because we had, you know, all these dozens and dozens of comics that we wrote for Scientific American. And so we could just republish those in the book or reinsert them, update them, of course, and make sure they were still worked. But I was like, okay, yeah, that's five more pages. We don't need to write.
Yeah, and there were some new ones, like, for example, the Phineas Gage comic. And there are several new things that we wrote. The one about Do Dogs Love Us, that's completely new. So
Yeah, there are a
I
ton of there's a ton of new comics in the book.
yeah, so thinking about the structure of the book, now that you bring it up, the thing that I was most inspired by, and I kept thinking about a little bit, was Watchmen, because Watchmen is sort of structured that way, where there's comics, and then there's complex narratives of more storyfied elements. So not obviously it's not a story like Watchmen, but it is it's that mashup of prose and comics that I think conveys the optimum amount of information that doesn't feel like you're consuming a textbook. And I think that's where we wanted to be at the end of this, was we wanted a complete enough story that if you went here and no further, you would come away having a very sophisticated understanding of your mind. But we didn't want to do it in such a way that you just it was a slog. We wanted it to be fun to read. That was, I think, the most important piece of this, is just making it fun.
And right here, let me say, Duane, the prose is amazing. I just loved it because it felt like you are kind of, just there or sitting at a table in a restaurant or something and telling us this stuff. And not, there's no lecture, there's no feeling of a textbook, but there's a ton of really interesting information. Talk about creating the prose, because I think it happens on two levels. One, just, the kind of simpler sentences than you might find in one of your science papers, but also too, in terms of, the stories you tell in the book itself.
Yeah. Well, first off, I want to give credit where credit's due. So, Jorge and I are co-authors
Oh,
in
okay.
every sense of the word. So, I would say that, yes, I wrote the first draft of every chapter, but he would go in and do heavy edits and help me to really guide the language and some of the organization to more of a storytelling format. And I would say that, on the comics piece, I'm not sitting there drawing, certainly, but I'm, sometimes I'll draft out what I think the idea should be in a particular comic. And that was, I think, the case with Scientific American, especially. And for things like this Phineas Gage piece, we would sort of pace it out together, and then Jorge would create the finished work. So, Jorge, you may want to speak into that, but that was my impression of our process, was that I'd write this chapter that was like three times longer than what it ended up being, and then Jorge would come in and say, "Oh, that's a lot. Can we dial it down a little bit and simplify it?" And and I think that's how we effectively work together.
Well, that speaks to the idea too that this doesn't feel like two voices going back and forth. It's very much one mind, one read. I didn't never thought about two people talking to me. I just enjoyed, the continuity, the story, and the illustrations. It was wonderful. So there you go. Now, Jorge, tell us about reading Duane's work.
Yeah, I know. I am deeply appreciative. For me, when I was working on the book, it was very much in the front of my mind that this is almost Duane's story. He's been the one studying the brain for 30 years. He is the one who's thought a lot about these things, and he's the one who's doing all of the background reading. So I see my job as just kind of taking his voice and then translating that to for a general audience, and bringing some of my experiences telling stories and bringing some of my experiences communicating science into that. So, you know, I always I'm in our process, Dwayne, and Rick, we would first discuss the outline, because I think after a few chapters, you're like, let's do an outline first before you completely rewrite all of my text. But yeah, so at the outline, we do kind of figure out what is the story. You know, when you're answering a question like, "What is love?" or "Will an AI, you know, replace my in my me in my job?" You know, what is the story you want to tell, and how does this story? What's the through line? How does this story sometimes diverge, but then comes back? These are all things we really kind of discussed at the beginning, and then Dwayne would go out and write something, and then we sort of filter through me for in the style of that you just kind of mentioned, where it's you feel like it's someone at a bar or at a restaurant talking to you, and it's one person, not two people.
You know, one of the things that I noticed too in this book is that stoicism makes an early appearance and it appears often. And I think it's an important part of this book because philosophy was, in a sense, our first attempts to understand our own mind. So perhaps talk about, you know, bringing your experiences with the Stoic philosophy and where it comes into the book and how it has retained some importance over thousands of years. It's very popular again these days.
Well, I can give it a try, Jorge, about some of that. A lot of it had to do with how do you tell the story of happiness and emotions. And of course, when you talk about emotions, you talk mainly about how we perform emotional regulation. And so a lot of those early ideas of the early Stoics are really very helpful. You're probably familiar with Marcus Aurelius and Meditations. A lot of his ideas have sort of transcended time and have come down and landed in a lot of what we now consider to be very effective therapies. There was, and for me personally, when I was coming up and sort of learning to regulate my own emotions, I would read about different types of therapies because I started as a psychologist and then sort of transitioned over into neuroscience. And so a lot of what I was reading in college had to do with Stoic philosophy and rational emotive behavioral therapy, cognitive behavioral therapies, things like that, that each of which sort of map back to Stoic philosophy. And the basics of Stoic philosophy, for folks in the audience that might not know, has to do with not letting events drive you, not being a victim of things that are happening to you, no matter what it is in life, whether it's you know, an unfortunate event in your life, maybe you had an accident, maybe someone said mean words to you or posted something mean about you on the internet. It's not just, okay, stimulus response. It's the stimulus, the thing that happened, your ideas about and self-talk and what you tell yourself about that event, and then how you allow yourself to feel about that. And it's not, you know, some people think stoicism is about ignoring emotions. It's sort of like the sort of Vulcan philosophy, right? That people say, well, Vulcans don't have emotions. Well, Vulcans have emotions. People have emotions. It's just that we're differently capable of regulating those emotions. So for me, the historic idea that stoicism transcends time and has things to teach us even to this day, I think is a very valuable thing to bring in. I was referring to stoicism just today because we, you know, I work at an academic medical center, and there are a lot of people freaked out and now because they think they're going to lose their federal grants or their grants are going to be paused. And I wrote a letter to our students just saying, you know, I'm reminded of this Persian 13th century Persian saying, "This too will pass." And you know, just sort of walk them through this from a sort of Stoic philosophy perspective about, you know, yes, some of these things may seem upsetting, but you know, we have had hard times as scientists before. We will have hard times in the future, and if we simply have faith in ourselves and our capacity and know that we've faced these hard times and we have the tools with which to do it, we will be okay. You as students will be okay. So for me, it's it is something that's been very central to my own identity. And so it was important for me that that be represented in our understanding and how we convey ideas about happiness, how we think about individuals like Viktor Frankl, people who have, you know, had extreme hardship in their life and how they have approached things that, you know, could destroy you, but they rose above it. They found ways to process what they were going through that allowed them to not only get through it and survive, but also to thrive and also to reach out and touch other people with those ideas.
Now,
so,
what,
okay, that may have landed differently for you. I'd like to hear what you thought about that chapter.
Oh, well, first of all, I should just say how much fun it is to work with you, Duane, because you're a dean, you're very high up in the university. And yet when I talk to you, you still make references to Watchmen in comic books and Star Trek. So that's fun. But I would say that was one of my favorite things about this book is, and you mentioned it in the introduction, just this idea that our search for understanding our brain spans all of these different disciplines, from philosophy to psychology to history to molecular, you know, chemistry. You know, that whole range is really amazing, and you sort of need that whole range to really understand the big picture of how our mind works. So for me, it was a pleasure and a joy just to learn about these things, to get to read about them, these topics that you bring up, because I wasn't that super familiar with Stoicism, but now I am, and I think it's made me a little happier.
You know, one of the basic questions you asked is tied to another one. You ask, what is consciousness? And you also ask, will an AI take my job? And this brings us to the idea of AI. And to be honest, this is something I have a tough time behind. I've been in the IT business for a bazillion years, and also I've read a boatload of science fiction that involves AI, and some of it has some very respectable thoughts. And when I see what we call, quote, AI now, I just think, well, you know, it's just a glorified search engine. It has no consciousness. But you bring up a really interesting point in that an AI may actually have a consciousness, but we would not be able to recognize it as such, because I think this comes to the import of embodiment. We all have, you know, two arms, two legs, a head, shoulders, a heart, and all that stuff. And AI has none of that. So the expectation that we could reproduce in using transistors and metal and circuits what we have, what kind of created within us with, you know, 200 pounds of mostly water is, you know, unlikely to say the least. So talk about, you know, just understanding what consciousness is and then how we would create artificial consciousness, and if that artificial consciousness would be recognizable and if it would, you know, be inclined to cause us harm or even be just inclined to pay attention to us in any way whatsoever.
How long is this podcast?
Oh, we got about 20 more minutes.
I'll take a stab at it. Okay. So first, consciousness. I think consciousness is certainly, it is sort of considered the third rail of neuroscience and psychology. People have difficulty talking about it. And people have, everybody that has a brain has sort of an idea of what consciousness means to them. So I guess it's probably useful to think about it first in terms of like, what's the basic definition of consciousness? You know, we know what it's like to be conscious, that is, you know, awake. And we know what it's like to be alert or to not be alert when we're awake. We know what it's like to be asleep and not conscious. We know what it's like to be dreaming, but be conscious of what the dream is about and actually follow a narrative inside that dream. So in a sense, you know, there is an element of consciousness even when we're at our deepest levels of sleep when we're dreaming. So a basic definition of consciousness for me, and what I think most people that are the sort of higher level theorists sort of considering what consciousness means, it is essentially the feeling of being you, the feeling that you have, that you are yourself, and that, you know, you, Rick, are not me, you're not Jorge, you are Rick, because you have grown up as Rick, your brain has developed as Rick, and you have created the feeling within yourself that you are who you are, a specific ego. And that you interact with people as that ego, and you know what it feels like to be that. The difficulty of consciousness that separates it from almost every brain function that we know about is that for something like vision, for example, you know, we can agree based on an external reference on what the color blue looks like, or we can agree what looks metallic to us, you know, so we have something that you and I can look at as an from our external reference and say, hey, you know, I can agree that blue, you know, maybe it's a blueberry. I can agree that blue is a blueberry blue versus the blue that's up in the sky. We don't really have that same reference point for what it feels to be ourselves. So I can't hold a piece of me out there and say, Rick, do you agree that's me and not you? You can't really do that. And so I think that's why it's so hard a concept for us to talk about and so easy to come up with different ideas about how it works. So I think what it boils down to is it's consciousness is an ability of a brain, or, you know, if you want to go into it in terms of AI, it would be the ability of an AI to have a concept of itself, and that concept is different or separate from what the concept would be for another computer sitting over here or another person that's sitting over there. So with respect to AIs and consciousness and artificial intelligence, it may be beyond what we need to get into and have time to get into for this, but there are different types of artificial intelligence, ranging from very simple systems that just model what a neuron does, and how neurons in the brain cells are neurons and how those things interact with one another, ranging all the way up to large language models, which are basically prediction machines. You know, as you indicated, these things seemed a little bit like a super Google and, you know, search engine. They're more than that because they are training and they're learning and they're able to reproduce what they have learned based on the number of elements that they have. But, you know, in essence, they're not, you know, would you say that tips over into consciousness? It sounds like you would not. There are others that might say that, well, you know, with a sufficient number of these elements, these neurons or computational parameters hooked together, maybe if you exceeded some value, then consciousness would just emerge from that. I think, you know, Jorge and I have, you know, even though we wrote this book together, we may have, I sort of sense when we were working on that chapter, we may have differences in our opinion about that. But my opinion is this, it's that brains are grown. And so, yes, you can train something based on training sets, and you can train artificial neural networks on different things so that when it sees a certain pattern again, it can respond to that, and it can maybe even extrapolate from that and come up with new and different and what appears to be creative things. But what it feels to be me is something that is unique and part of the development of my brain, how it actually wired together in the beginning, how it perceives the world as an evolved organ, and what it feels like when my stomach growls and I know that I'm hungry. And, you know, those sorts of conscious perceptive things that happen in a body, that's important. And the emotions that I feel, because, you know, my sadness is probably different than your sadness, but that's part of my consciousness and what it feels to be me. So bottom line, I would put a button on this for my part of this and just say, I feel like consciousness is the feeling of being you in all of the glory that that represents. And yes, will machines get there? I think we will have, you know, my feeling is we will have artificial general intelligence. We will have the Mr. Datas walking around someday. I don't think it's imminent based on the systems that we see right now and some of the limited capacity and some of the mistakes and hallucinations that they have. It will be difficult to figure it out simply because we're not that good at figuring out whether, you know, so if I had to prove, Rick, that you were conscious, how would I do that? How would you prove that I am conscious and not just some zombie walking around? You have a sense of that, but, you know, our history of doing things like measuring intelligence, it's flawed because it comes from the perspective of, well, we think we know, we're going to put together the test. You know, we're generating the test of what it means to be conscious. Maybe there's a different set of questions though, that need to be asked.
Or Jorge?
Yeah. You know, I think that this book was really cool because I feel like, Dwayne, we went a little bit beyond what most books do in trying to define and talk about consciousness. And I like where we landed to explain what consciousness is, which is that we wrote in the book that it's sort of like, imagine you're a machine, right? And we are sort of machines. We're just biological machines. And we need to survive in the world. We need to have an awareness, a model of the world outside of us just to survive, just to be able to navigate it and, you know, find food and find places to sleep in and things like that. But consciousness is sort of the same thing. It's sort of our awareness of the world, but it's our awareness of our inner self, of like our own bodies, our own state of mind. So it's sort of like a sense, it's like a feeling, it's like a, it's like you said, it's the feeling of being you, but it's, to put it a little bit more concretely in the book, it's sort of like the same as we have an awareness of the outside world. Consciousness is our awareness of our inside world. And I think what's interesting too that you just brought up is this idea that consciousness is not like a on or off thing. It's not like you have consciousness or not. You know, we sort of talk about this in the book, how you can have sort of like gradations of consciousness. Like a dog maybe is not, let me go back. Like maybe you can have a very clear awareness of what's around you, or you can have a very limited awareness of what's around you. You know, you might see every detail and be aware of every detail of the room you're in, or you can just maybe have a very simple sense of like, okay, I'm in a dark room or I'm in a lit room. In that same way, awareness, consciousness can be sort of have that variation. You can be very aware of everything that's happening in your brain and all the thoughts and feelings and things, or you can have a very limited awareness of your own self. And so it can be sort of have this variation, you know, like a dog maybe has a little bit of consciousness, maybe it's sort of aware of its own feelings and it knows if it's sad or happy maybe, or if it feels good or doesn't feel good, but it doesn't have the same level of consciousness maybe that a human does. And so you can have this variability. And so in that sense, I think I sort of maybe disagreed a little bit on you with you on this idea of AI and whether it can have consciousness. You know, maybe conscious AIs can have a little bit of consciousness too, the same way that a dog has. We might not ever get to the point, or we might not let ever, never, we might not ever allow this to happen, but it it might have a consciousness at the level that humans do. But most likely it'll just be, you know, glimmers of consciousness, probably sort of like a dog or a hamster have.
Well, they'll never be accused, my pugs. You know, one of the things I think that this book does is it covers a really great range, and it shows that how the questions you ask and the way you treat this, it's really exciting to read from one piece to the next because you kind of confine each area of questions and talk about, like, you know, making little containers for these examinations of the brain, like what makes us happy. I mean, that's a question that a lot of people want the answer to.
Yeah, I think that was something that was really compelling to me was, can you put these things in a box? And I think, you know, obviously, too, it's a little bit of an artifice because you need to sort of organize things and talk about them in the way that makes sense and really serves the question that you're trying to answer and that we were trying to answer in a particular chapter. But obviously, these things interact, right? So, you know, what makes us happy has a lot to do with, you know, love and hate and all of those other emotions. Consciousness is like all of this stuff sort of balled up together. So, you know, the ideas of love and hate and, you know, our ability to resist addiction and, you know, what sorts of things might drive us toward certain behaviors, all of that factors into some of the bigger ideas about consciousness. There's also chapters in there about how where the brain came from. You know, and I think understanding a little bit about where the brain came from an evolutionary perspective, is actually very important about understanding where we are today and what it is that the brain was originally intended to do, what kind of problems a brain solved early in evolution that might then point to, well, here's how that particular problem has been solved and how society has made it so that our brains now are sort of sitting around twiddling our thumbs looking for other things to do, some of which can be very good for us, but other things that might not be so good for us.
Well, you give us the story, and that's what, and I think that Jorge does a great job of, you know, keeping that story really, I guess, light at heart, but really on point. And that's important to keep us reading, and it's really fun and very interesting story. Talk about, you know, the development of the story over the span of the book, where you begin and where you end.
Yeah, all very interesting sort of discussions that we had starting this book. You know, first of all, I think it was really important to us that each chapter give you an answer to the question it's posing. So, like Dwayne said,
these things are satisfying answers too. Let me say,
yeah, exactly. Well, thank you. Yeah, satisfying answers, and that's hard because, as Dwayne said, it's complicated. You know, to understand certain things, you need to understand things from another chapter or another topic. Or, for example, you know, you sort of have to understand a little bit about neurons and neurotransmitters and some of the chemistry that goes on in the brain very early on. But we also wanted the book to be able to be read in any order. So we imagine some people might sit down and read this from start to finish, and some people might pick it up and be like, oh, I want to know how love works, or I want to know how addiction works, and they might skip around. So it was definitely a challenge, I think, to be able to make each chapter self-contained and be able to be read out of order. And that's where I think we had to really fight that instinct to, like, oh no, let's make it like a textbook. Let's just talk about neurons and chemicals first, and then we can talk about all these other things. No, we said we gotta be able to talk about love from the get-go, or be able to talk about what makes us human from the get-go. And then in terms of the story telling, Rick, that you mentioned, that's something that I think works really well when you have two authors like this. You know, one person maybe brings a story and the other person serves as can stand in as the reader in a way and be able to tell, okay, now we're deviating off topic. Let's, you know, bring it back in. And so it was definitely this interplay between the two of us where, you know, Dwayne had a very strong story that he wanted to tell, and I read it and I could interpret that as a reader and be like, oh no, we're getting off topic here. Let's go back and things like that.
No, I think we easily cut as much out of the book as ended up in the book.
Your frustration.
My first versions were something like 7,000 words, and we'd cut it down to like 3,000 or 3,500 for each chapter. So we definitely killed our darlings a lot.
in service
of the story.
Well, too, one of the things I think that makes this really interesting as a book about neuroscience is you cover topics and say, we're going to cover this topic as neuroscience, for example, what makes us happy? Do we have free will? Or what happens when we die? I mean, this is not necessarily a topic you're going to expect in a book about neuroscience. Well, we're dead. As they call them, flatline,
that's a
dude.
Heavy subject, right? But you know, it was something that had to be in there, right? If you're really going to have a book about the biggest questions of the human brain, what's a bigger question about the human brain than what happens when it stops and what happens to us afterward? Now we don't, you know, because we're scientists, we don't really state anything about what happens that moment. But after everything just completely shuts down. But what we can say is we can tell the story of what happens up to that point. And, you know, one of the really enjoyable parts of it was looking at what near-death experience means to some people. Some, you know, several people have reported, well, I've come close to dying, or perhaps I was being, you know, getting surgery and they said that I coded and I had this experience. And it's interesting to explore that and find out, is there a scientific basis for these really intense experiences that not just Americans have, but it's something that people have around the world. So it has to be something common about either the structure of the brain or how the brain works that wants to create meaning out of something that dramatic. And the wonderful thing about it was where I was left was with that chapter was that death is sort of the brain's last gift to you, that the sort of patterns of activity and the neurochemicals that it releases is actually a way to help you at a time when you're at your weakest and perhaps on your way out. And so, you know, I sort of considered that as the brain's last gift. And then we quickly, very quickly transitioned because it was a really heavy topic into, well, you know, can we cheat death? And, you know, so we gave ourselves an escape hatch on that so that, I'm sitting here, I'm very depressed about this idea that I might be dying. And yeah, I've learned a lot of cool things, but it kind of sucks. And I think, you know, sort of picking up with that and say, but there's hope. And, you know, talk about the things that people have talked about in terms of transhumanism and can we transcend the idea of death scientifically, and can we do things like, you know, roll back aging and live forever? And what would that mean if we could do that? So, you know, some really just interesting ideas in that overall area that I think certainly we felt compelled not to have that be a downer, but to actually sort of salvage it and sort of make it scientifically interesting and sort of grapple with some of the larger questions surrounding, you know, the fact that what happens when we're no longer here.
Yeah, and we put it right after things. The what makes something funny chapter too.
Yeah, right. Yeah, we had to salvage it somehow. To me, one of the concepts there was the idea about, you know, personal projects and how people deal with the idea behind the fact that they won't be here someday. And so this Ernest Becker, The Denial of Death book was a strong motivator for me in terms of how to structure that chapter and thinking about things in terms of, you know, how the brain comes to anticipate, but also deny the idea of your own demise. And so, you know, this book in some sense is one of those projects, right? So part of the way we deal with our impermanence is that we think of ourselves as a parent and that our children will go on, you know, beyond us and we'll do better. And, you know, we can think about that and that helps to offset that fear of death. We can think about things like this book. You know, this book presumably will still be available, even if cockroaches are running around over it, they'll be able to enjoy the book in some way. You know, that will transcend our existence on this planet. So that sort of project, I think, was also, you know, it helps you deal with the idea that you're no longer be here. People that are good in business, people that are, you know, have strong feelings of religious experience, feel that there is an afterlife for them, and that's part of their process for denying their own mortality, or at least embracing or accepting their own mortality, is that, hey, maybe we're not completely gone when we're gone. So, Jorge, I don't know how any of that landed with you, but
oh no, for sure,
a lot of heavy stuff.
That was a very, that was a definitely very profound chapter to write and to learn about. I wonder, Dwayne. These days, I think a lot about my kids and what they're gonna know about me in the future. And these books are definitely one way that I'm thinking about them learning more about me. You know, they're a little bit young now to be reading these types of books, but maybe in the future, that's something that they can look to and be like, okay, this is sort of how my father thought about things and talked about things. I wonder if you also, I know when your kids, one of your kids read the book, right?
Yeah, one of my kids, Lucas, actually did some proofreading for us. So he went into it in a great deal of detail. He's a lawyer, so he was looking at it from my perspective. not that we would get sued or anything, but just from, you know, just being someone who was used to going through a lot of complex text and giving us some
interesting
very specific
wow.
feedback on grammar and.
Oh, really? Did he give you?
Interesting.
Wow.
Yeah. So, yeah, I resonate with that. I would say that probably I wouldn't have been as interested in writing the book had I not been a father, because it is sort of something that I feel, okay, it's really, really hard to communicate the essence of yourself and what your thoughts are and what it is you do, especially in real time, you know, because, you know, when you're interacting with your kids, you know, you're an adult, you're doing adult things, and you're experiencing the world in a very different way. So your children can't know you at that point in time in the way that they will know you when they are adults themselves. Mm-hmm. And I feel like books like this are opportunities to, you know, tell them about yourself are important.
Or even if in the future they think, I wonder what my dad, what advice he would give about what it means to be happy, or how to deal with certain situations,
yeah,
or
absolutely.
How to think about the future. Hopefully they'll read this
death,
book.
You know, I think there is kind of a truth there where, you know, writing the book helped me to sort of think of it as a love letter to my family.
Well, that's profound. The new book by Dwayne Godwin and Jorge Tam is Out of Your Mind. Thank you for joining me, gentlemen.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for having us, Rick.
It was a lot of fun.
You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony.